Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are. My name is Dirk Pilat and I'm the Medical Director for E-Learning and Accreditation at the RCGP. Today we will be talking about the nexus between influenza and COVID-19, and I couldn't wish for a better colleague to help me with the topic. Incidentally, George was made a commander of the British Empire a few days ago. Alas, they didn't give him a ship. George, could you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, hello. I'm George Cassianos. I was GP for 38 years until 3 years ago when I retired to concentrate entirely on vaccinations and immunizations. I was born in Cyprus, started my studies in Athens, but soon after got a scholarship from the International Union of Students to study medicine in Poland. That I did. And then I moved after my studies to London, where I train as a GP at the Hammersmith and St. Mary's Hospital. And after that, I joined my practice in Bracknell, where I work in the same practice for 38 years.
And now you focus on immunization and vaccination. I believe you have a few roles in that department as well.
Yes, I have been the national immunization lead for the Royal College of GPs for 24 years. Next year will be a quarter of a century. I also chair a pan-European group on influenza called RAISE, which stands for Raise Awareness of Influenza Strategies in Europe. And I'm on the board of the ESWIG, which is the European Scientific Working Group on Influenza, and also president of the British Global and Travel Health Association.
With other words, I can't imagine having anybody more qualified to talk about influenza and COVID-19. A really strange 7 months in general practice with the advent of COVID-19. And we're now looking at a second wave of the pandemic coming towards us with, if we're unlucky, influenza present in the community as well. George, could you remind us, please, about the clinical differences between COVID-19 and the flu?
Yes, the symptoms in the case of COVID really start slowly. But with influenza, you can actually notice it in the morning. By the evening, you can actually move very, very, very fast. Fever is really shared by both. In fact, 99% of cases of COVID, you expect fever. Cough is the next symptom that they share as well. And we see that in about 60% of cases of COVID. Loss of smell and taste is common with COVID, but you only see it sometimes when it comes to influenza. Fatigue, our patients with COVID really suffer from this very frequently, while it is just common as regards to influenza. And myalgia, very common in influenza, but you only get it sometimes with COVID. A runny and stuffy nose is rare with COVID, and sometimes you get it with influenza. If you really get a snuffy nose, you're probably dealing with a common cold, probably. Again, with sneezing, if you see the patient sneezing more, you've got more of a chance that that's actually a cold. Headaches is another problem that patients present with influenza and is common, but is sometimes COVID-19. On the other hand, shortness of breath, it's a presenting symptom with COVID-19, while we don't really see that as a presenting symptom with influenza. Abdominal pain and diarrhea, the children suffer with this in influenza, and is the same with COVID. The children can present with diarrhea. As regards to adults, it's rare. The other important thing is actually how long do the symptoms last. In influenza, they will last for about a week, 5 to 7 days, while in COVID-19, mild cases will last for about 2 weeks, but severe or critical disease can last 3 to 4 weeks. And of course, once the symptoms have continued for more than 3 months, and that happens in about 20% of cases of COVID, that is then long-term COVID, which we now call long COVID. And that's actually very important to remember about this particular problem. The big, big challenge we have with COVID is the fact that patients can be asymptomatic so much more frequently than what they do with influenza. In fact, various papers put it anything between 10% to 80% people being totally asymptomatic. And of course, you have got also the person who is going to develop symptoms, but about a day or two before they develop symptoms, they're also infectious. So there you are.
So for me, the most important thing to take away is the difference in acuity of symptoms. What about oxygen saturation? We all have heard patients with COVID-19 who were saturating quite low while not being particularly short of breath.
Respiratory conditions generally, we thought, are driven by this shortness of breath. But in the case of COVID, what you have is vasculitis and coagulopathy to the point that the usual doses of anticoagulants don't actually work. You have to actually use much higher doses, different anticoagulants for it to actually get the patient to a stable condition. And that's a big, big problem we have actually seen in the intensive care units.
So patients, so the reason that they saturate so low is not so much due to the effective changes, but due to the vasculitic changes.
Yes, and the coagulopathy in the pulmonary arteries, and of course you are sending back to the heart poorly oxygenated blood, which comes back to you, and you go down with your saturation, and that's a big problem.
Mm. That's already quite worrying for general practitioners. But now one step further, do you think that there is increased susceptibility if you have one or the other to get one of the other? So instance, if you already have influenza, is it more likely that you pick up or that you're more symptomatic due to COVID?
Well, the two conditions actually do differ as regards to their fatality rate. In the case of influenza, the fatality rate is put at 0.01% to 0.05%, while the fatality rate for COVID-19 is generally 1%. But in the elderly and in those with chronic disease or gross obesity, it can be much, much higher. It can be anything between 1% to 14%. And some papers have actually quoted figures as much as 40%. Now, with the obesity, that's a very big problem, especially patients who are grossly obese with a BMI more than 40. And the usual advice is lose weight. But in fact, we find that if the patient who has got really excess weight, really overweight, losing weight quickly, paradoxically, increases the mass of the ACE2 receptors and may worsen their situation. So this is a virus that is so, so different than all the other viruses we have known in the past.
Okay, so do you think that co-infection can exist?
Well, co-circulation of coronavirus and influenza viruses really threatens to increase morbidity and mortality and overwhelm healthcare resources and systems. This is a problem that if you get it, it's actually very difficult to cope with. Not only that, but what the chances for dying actually increase if you actually get both. Now, if you actually get COVID and influenza, compared to somebody who is not infected, you have got 6 times higher risk of dying because you have got COVID and influenza.
Goodness.
If we take the risk of dying from COVID-19 S1, then adding influenza to COVID-19 increases your chance for dying by, well, more than double, 2.27, according to a very recent paper we had. So really, we must do everything we can to prevent the respiratory disease we can, and they are namely influenza and pneumococcal disease. So influenza vaccine and pneumococcal vaccine for every patient in the groups at risk is extremely important, because that is the respiratory disease we can prevent.
That of course means that we should have another look at our disease registers and check whether there are patients out there eligible for the pneumococcal vaccine and invite them quickly.
Yes, oh. It is very important, as we do mass vaccination or vaccination in the practice, when we see the adult and the older adult, not only we should think of vaccinating them against influenza, but check whether they have had their pneumococcal vaccine in the past, and if not, really consider vaccination. Also, consider their shingles vaccine if they're between 70 and 80. And the good thing about recent decision from the Public Health England is that any patient who has had their 80th birthday, they're still eligible for their shingles vaccine until the 31st of December. This is a concession the Royal College of GPs asked Public Health England to make, and they did it. So please remember the shingles vaccine and the pneumococcal vaccine when you see a patient for influenza vaccination.
I am going to show you my ignorance now. Is it possible to vaccinate people at the same time?
Yes.
For pneumococcus and influenza?
Very much so. You can actually give all three on the deltoid, as long as you allow 2.5 centimeters, 1 inch, in between the two that you're going to give on one side, and then the other on the other side.
Well, that's certainly one of the most practical things I've learned for a long time.
Now, it may be a good idea to give the shingles vaccine on one arm, a live vaccine, and then the two kill vaccines on the other arm.
Definitely. So far, things have been rather gloomy. I nevertheless know that you've been keeping an eye on the data from the Southern Hemisphere, particularly Australia and New Zealand, who are, of course, just coming out of their winter. Could you give us an idea how they did?
Yes, Australia and New Zealand did something similar, but they do differ in what they have achieved. In Australia, they have a population of about 25 million. They purchased 15 million doses of influenza vaccine, and they were left with 1.5 million, which means they have vaccinated 54% of their population generally. And in fact, they gave about 37% more vaccines this year than year before. And we are seeing probably the same happening here in the UK. What they saw, it was a very huge rush to get vaccinated, because they gave a message to patients that patients with COVID-19 and influenza are likely to have to do significantly worse if they get both infections. And patients got that message and came and got vaccinated. And that's why they had such a great response. But what they have also seen is that the lockdown, the social and physical distancing they introduced, as well as the personal hygiene in the form of frequent hand washing, the schools closing during the lockdown, all that contributed to a huge reduction in the circulation of respiratory viruses. And in fact, when I ask Rob, my other neighbor in Australia, how much influenza did you see? He said, we hardly saw any influenza. And that's actually very encouraging for us, because if we can do a good job like the Australian GPs, then we should really see very little or no influenza actually circulating. If you go to New Zealand now, if I quote Michael Baker, the New Zealand doctor that deals with influenza, he said that there has been near extinction of influenza in New Zealand following their very effective COVID-19 response. And he actually said that the numbers actually vanish from these two standard systems of surveillance they have there in New Zealand. resulting in a staggering 99.8% reduction in flu cases. Now, when they had the lockdown, they saw a reduction in rhinoviruses and RSV, but soon after the lockdown, those numbers went up. But one thing that he actually mentioned, and that impressed me a lot, and we need to have that in mind, although we do vaccinate our children for the streptococcus, is the fact that during the lockdown in New Zealand, they saw a rise in rheumatic fever cases. This may be possibly due to people staying home, often in overcrowded homes, which increased the risk, but this may have also been affected by less access to routine healthcare during the lockdown from throat swabbing and treatment. And that's very important for us to remember here in the UK. Take swabs, really check the patient.
It would be amazing if we could replicate these numbers. Do you think the widening of eligibility for flu jabs to the 50-year-olds is going to help?
Well, the first thing to remember is this, that we bought vaccines for our groups at risk back in January, February, and now we see them coming to us for vaccination in greater numbers than ever before, which is very pleasing, excellent, but it is possible that some practices may run out of vaccine. Well, the good news is that from the middle of October, we can actually put an order for vaccines with the government's 8 million doses they have, which will be delivered to us in November. Now, by mid-November, all vaccine manufacturers will have delivered their vaccines, in which case every practice will know whether they need more vaccines or not, and they are available from the government. Okay. The question now is, what about the 50 to 64-year-olds that are healthy? Because those in the groups at risk, they are eligible for the vaccine, they should come forward, we should vaccinate them. This is a group that starts having more chronic disease than the younger age groups. It started to do worse with COVID-19 from the age of about 50. Why? Because immunosenescence kicks in not at 65, it's actually much earlier. And it's about from the age of 50 onwards, we start not responding to vaccines so well, but also we don't respond so well to infection. And therefore, if there is a group of patients to vaccinate because COVID-19 is still around, is the group of 50 to 64 against influenza. If it was influenza and no COVID, the group of people that we will go and vaccinate will be the children, because they are the most efficient, effective spreaders of influenza viruses. But this is COVID-19, which does not involve so much the children, but involves the older adults and adults. And that is why we need to vaccinate the 50 to 64-year-olds if we have got any vaccine left. Our priority are the groups at risk from the Green Book, from our contract. We need to get them in September, October, November, complete vaccination. And then by December, we're ready really to start vaccinating the 50 to 64-year-olds if we have any vaccine left.
And do you think that the extension to the 50-year-olds is going to show a further reduction in circulating influenza?
Yes, I'm confident that they will do. In fact, year on year, the Royal College of GPs Research and Surveillance Center, run by Simon Delusinian, shows that the one group of people, one cohort, visits GPs with influenza-like illness more than any other group, year on year on year. Who they are? Who are they? They are the 18 to 64. Uh-huh. What do we do for them? We only vaccinate those in the groups at risk. So the message is healthy people need to be vaccinated too. And in the United States, as we all know, the recommendation is for influenza vaccination is everybody aged 6 months and over should be vaccinated against influenza. Why not under 6 months? Because no vaccine is licensed for that age, but we do vaccinate the mother to protect the baby. And this is how, this is very important to vaccinate every pregnant woman that is pregnant now or becomes pregnant during the influenza season.
Well, this is certainly a positive spin and a positive ending. And I have to say, I am a little bit more optimistic now after speaking to you, George. Thank you so much for your time. Again, congratulations for your CBE. I hope that you're going to have an amazing celebration with your family and friends. And stay safe this winter, although I have a feeling that I don't have to tell you that. Goodbye.
Goodbye.